All right, well, we might as well get going. So much to cram in, right? And I think we might have given you an anxiety attack with all the endocrine stuff that we did last time, right? Was it a lot? It was a lot, right? Yes. So, I mean, like, relax with that. It's not about trying to hit all those disease states. It's just the general ideas. If you get too much growth hormone, you grow too much, right? If it's before puberty, you become gigantic. If it's before puberty, you get acromegaly, all your tissues grow. Boom, that's it. You know, but also growth hormone goes up. So take it as a, growth hormone goes up, glucose goes up, right? That was the other main point we talked about. So that's it for that. You know, so, you know, kind of compartmentalized. I know it's a lot, and you might kind of be freaking, but when you start to dig into it, it's the main points that we hit, right? Okay. And then on the quiz, I'm about halfway through grading the quiz. Some really hard to read writing, but I understand that because my writing is pathetic also. So I try to read through it and try to figure out what people are writing. Sometimes I'm emailing a person with a screenshot and a picture from my iPhone saying, I really can't read that, so if you kind of print that out and type it so I can get it. So that's been some of the slowing down on that too. But you can see how and I know that was quick, right? You had a lot of time, but you got to think about if you're taking standardized exams too, or actually other exams, if you really know the material, then you can go pretty quick, right? So I want to try to go over the quiz a little bit, but actually grading the quiz and going through that, I realized again, and I promised myself last year I wouldn't do that to myself again, when we had so many open response questions for the lab, when we had the lab, the quiz in the lab, the test, I should say, in the lab, it took me like 3 solid days to grade everybody's exams. And so I thought, do I really want to torture myself like that again? But it's so informative to understand what you really know, because on an open response you can't guess, right? But you like guessing, I know that, because then you get a chance. But so I thought maybe we'll reduce those open response questions like I really wanted to do and do more multiple choice on the test. Okay, so next week's test, we got a test next week, right? Everybody knows that, right? Because some people don't know we have quizzes on the day that it's actually posted on the website, and then get a 0. It's really bad. So do come for the test in lab next week, right? And then so there's probably more multiple choice, and you could probably finish in an hour, and then you have some open response questions. And the open response questions give you more points than 100, so I think you can make 102 or maybe 104. I'm trying to get finish that off. So there's kind of your bonus, so we hope to get people more than 100% on it. And then a lot of multiple choice. Now, what would we do for those 3 hours in lab? I just don't know. We would need those 3 hours. So I'm wondering, I know this is what you're going to like, good thing you don't have oranges, so you can't throw them at me. Wondering if maybe we might cover a little bit of lecture material in before the exam, but I'm still debating. I know you don't like that. But if, you know, or maybe do something that we can have some activity, right, while we're there. But anyways, you probably won't need the whole 3 hours, okay? So it should go relatively quick, but that will save a lecture time, so maybe I'll just use a lecture time. Because we're not taking the test in class. But relax, it's not going to be as open, as many open response questions as I originally planned. Okay? Is that better? You can guess? Guess right? Okay? That's smart. And then I'll be able to grade them quicker and get them back to you too. So let's go through this quiz. Can you see that up there? Right. Did y'all take the quiz? Yes, most of you guys are all around here pretty much. But there's a number of people that just didn't show up, even though it's posted on the website, the date and everything. Okay. And do some of you recognize these quiz questions? They're right out of the test bank, right? Same questions, just cut and pasted, because I'm lazy, right? I'm lazy. And you get the idea also about that same topic, right, for next week. I'm kind of lazy. Right? So, what do? All right. Okay. All right. Not totally lazy, but somewhat lazy. All right.
So acetylcholine esterase is an enzyme that degrades acetylcholine. Remember, in like your neuromuscular junction, what effect does nerve transmission would occur following the administration of a chemical that inhibited acetylcholine esterase, like an insecticide? All right. So remember, just to kind of put all that in context again, acetylcholine esterase is made in the nerve as well as in the muscle, and it's actually then put into like the synaptic cleft. That's pretty unusual. So acetylcholine is released. It wants to go across and bind to acetylcholine receptors at your neuromuscular junction. Those are nicotinic, right? At your skeletal neuromuscular junction. And acetylcholine esterase chews that up. And so it basically, it keeps it from rebinding when it comes off. It won't keep rebinding to the receptors. So it cleaves it, and then part of it's taken back up in the nerve terminal, and the rest kind of goes away. We didn't go through all those details about what part is taken up, but the general idea. And insecticides can inhibit that. Nerve gas agents, some of those inhibit that. So what would happen if acetylcholine stayed around and you took away that enzyme? It would keep rebinding, right? So acetylcholine would build up, causing the postsynaptic cell to depolarize, thus, and then remaining active for a short time, possibly followed by desensitization. So that's the point, is that if you put acetylcholine on for a long time, it's going to activate it, but then those receptors, remember, they bind, open up, and then they go into a desensitized state, and they can't open again. This is the way to basically allow acetylcholine normally to get out of the cleft and be ready for the next bolus of acetylcholine, but without having it rebinding as it comes off. And we've talked about that before, but I just want to reemphasize that point, okay? It's not that they're going to be more sensitive or any of these other things. So you can kind of go through the process of elimination. Does anybody have questions on that? I've had to put my glasses on to see if I see hands. Okay, no hands. All right, great, okay. Amino acid-based hormones. Amino acid, what do we mean by that? Proteins, right? So proteins, not a steroid, and so it's not cholesterol. We're not dealing with the second messengers if these are protein, amino acid-based hormones, right? Binding to a receptor on the cell surface could be an inotropic response, but basically we're talking about protein hormones, right? Protein hormones. I thought that was a gimme, but some people chose different things, probably test anxiety or something. I don't know. Okay, so, and then the other one, which of the following endocrine glands is not primarily controlled by the pituitary gland? So what's in the pituitary gland? LH, right? What else? Anybody remember? FSH. ACTH. Is that one of them? Yes. Growth hormone? Is growth hormone in there? No? Yes. And this pituitary gland is also, we just had it generally, so you could say anterior and posterior, right? Because we didn't define this. So what's in the posterior? Oxytocin and ADH, right? Okay. Is there any other ones here? Prolactin. Okay. And maybe some others. So we think about which of these following endocrines is not primarily controlled by the pituitary gland. Well, FSH and TH and LH, we've talked about, even though they're female generally, like luteinizing hormone and follicle stimulating hormone, FSH promotes sperm production in males, LH promotes the testes to secrete testosterone. And so now we have, you know, those are going to work on the testes. We have, oh, we forgot something over here, didn't we? Thyroid stimulating hormone. All right, TSH, right? Is that one of them? Okay. Anybody remember? Yes. And so that's going to work on the thyroid. Where does ACTH work? Adrenal cortex. Oh, we got one left, right? So, you know, what is not? And so adrenal medulla, right? Okay. This next one, what was the corny thing we said multiple times? Glucagon, Canadians like to say, I can say that because I lived in Canada, so I'm not criticizing Canadians. Okay, my son's Canadian, or he was until he had to drop a citizenship. Okay, so glucagon, A cells, all right? A cells, right? Somebody put G cells. I had muscle cells. I had crazy answers on this. So I thought that was a gimme because we talked about it so much. We made the crazy analogy of, you know, alpha cells and a glucagon. Okay. This one should ring a bell. I think we've seen that on a quiz, actually, before, too, right? Boatfish or skeletal muscle of the rattlesnake, you know, how can you contract and relax? How do you contract? Right? Nerve, and you should have written this down by now. Blank piece of paper. Action potential comes down the nerve, right? What does it do at the nerve terminal? Opens up special channels called... We'll do whatever you call it. What do they call that when they draw on the board? And people guess what? Yeah, something like that. So C4. No, this is not working. C for calcium. Okay. So calcium, pulsatile calcium channels open up. Calcium comes in the nerve terminal. Vesicles fuse. Vesicles fuse, release the transmitter, right? Acetylcholine in these cases. The neuromuscular junction binds to receptors, depolarize the membrane. What happens? It goes down a T-tubule. If you're thinking about your muscles, then what happens? Oh, it causes a... What protein to sense that depolarization? On the T-tubule? Dihydropyridine receptor, right? We call that because dihydropyridine binds to it. That then is connected internally inside the cell to the ranitidine, which is on the sarcoplasmic reticulum, right? And then that pulls the plug and calcium comes out and calcium binds to... Troponin C causes a conformational change, exposes an active site, myosin's waiting for it, boom, binds, contracts, right? That's your contraction. So that should just be autonomic. You should just have that down, just like knowing your name, okay? And then, how do you get relaxation from that? Well, you stop the stimulation, for one thing, right? So you don't keep doing that. But then, how do you get the heads to come off ATP, right? You know, that thing. And then, why does it not kind of bind again? Because the calcium has been reuptaken into the sarcoplasmic reticulum to then cause a conformational change of the troponin complex to then hide the active site again, right? So even though the heads come back, it can't bind to the active site. So how fast that process can work, like taking up the calcium, will let that muscle relax again. So contract, relax, like the shaker of the rattlesnake or that boatfish that can hum really quick, that high frequency, that has to go on really fast. So, the point is, that's really fast. If you had calcium high levels for a prolonged time in the myoplasm, what would happen? It's going to stay contracted, right, with the high calcium. So you can't relax, so you can't have that back and forth like the rattlesnake tail or the boatfish. So it's the same thing about calcium uptake from the myoplasm, cytoplasm, back in the sarcoplasmic reticulum really fast, right? And we said that you could actually stain for the pump on the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and when you see muscle with a lot of those pumps on the sarcoplasmic reticulum, you pretty well could guess the physiology that's a fast type of muscle that can relax and contract. So again, structure kind of function relationships, and you know this holds throughout pretty much. So if you had open response questions, maybe not on this test, but maybe another final exam, yeah, then you know like structure function relationships. Then you might, use that too. Okay. Now, we took off the name. So, I wanted to go over this and help you out on this to try to think about these processes. Now, we could just speed on with more stuff, but I'll put this over there too. Okay. I want to think about how you would answer these questions and to do this kind of quickly so you get this down. But you have to know the content, right? So, what's a reasonable... You know, reasonable, and this, I know there was a typo in the write-up, but generally you got it instead of tiered, tired, or something like that. What's a reasonable reason that the person had a boost of energy to pedal faster and speed up, even though they felt, you know, lethargic, like they couldn't move? Somebody asked during the test what lethargic meant. It's okay if you don't know a definition of a term or something, you know, raise your hand. This is one idea, too, to have the exam in the lab, so it's just like 20 people, and I can help answer questions if you're confused about something or just don't understand the term, but, you know, tired feeling right before an incident. Okay, so what happened? How did they get the boost of energy as this vicious dog was chasing them? Some people left a lot of these blank, actually. Parts blank. Not good. You don't like that. Right, it was a sunny day or something, at least. You know, I get some humor out of it. So pedaling faster and speeding up. So what would be a reasonable boost of energy? Endocrine. So here's like a half a point for each. You know, endocrine and neural response. Let's think of neural response. You're scared. All of a sudden, we said we got a pop test today. Oh, your heart rate goes up. Why does it go up? Sympathetic response, right? So there's your neural. Sympathetic response. Neural response. Sympathetic. Right? And so here's the thing that I emailed. A lot of people forgot. So you could have just wrote here for this, like, sympathetic, and I would know what you mean. What does it go to? Sympathetic, how does it raise the heart rate? A lot of people went right to the adrenal medulla, right? So you could write, you know, adrenal medulla, and that would be okay. I would know what you mean. And what happens from the adrenal medulla? Epi, norepi, right? You could write that. And then maybe you stopped right there. And, I know what you mean, that would have an effect on the heart, but then you want the next arrow there, increase heart rate. Okay? You get it? You could do this all by arrows. You don't have to write the whole thing out. And then, but this is kind of the neuro, but then there's endocrine in here with the epi, right? And norepi. And then what else does a sympathetic do? It goes directly to the heart, and that's going to raise heart rate. All right, so there's more neural. So that would have answered that question, and you get half and half. So a lot of people are missing half because they maybe just did the neural, or they just said epinephrine. I don't know. Maybe you think epinephrine slows the heart down or speeds up. I don't know, right? I have to assume you understand it. Some people wrote acetylcholine. What happens if you put acetylcholine and wrote increased vagal nerve activity? What happens if you increase the vagal nerve activity? What's going to happen to your heart rate? It's going to slow down, not speed up, right? So, you know, you missed some points there. So actually, the open response question lets me see how much we're doing. And some of these might be redundant in the ones of how to answer it. So heart rate and breathing rate increased at this time of escaping. So how did this happen? Well, again, you know, just to make sure we get it, kind of giving you the extra push. Sympathetic response, right? And this could happen directly on the heart, increase the heart rate, like we just said, neural. You know, and breathing. So this could increase the CNS sense of, anxiety. You could just write CNS in here. And then that's going to drive respiration. You know, maybe the motor neurons are the centers in respiration in your brainstem to increase your breathing rate. So you could write brainstem if you wanted to. It depends on, I try to give as many points as that possibly could, and then drive respiratory neurons, for example. Okay, and that increases breathing rate. Some people wrote here about oxygen and, you know, getting more oxygen in, or the oxygen went down and that caused increasing breathing rate. What did we do in the outreach center when we were over there? Or even here, we had somebody put a little thing on their finger and look at percent saturation of oxygen. You remember that? And they were holding their breath and they had to breathe because they held their breath so long. But what happened to the percent oxygen saturation in their blood? It didn't change, right? But they had the drive to breathe. Remember when we blew into those little colored things that we had, right? So what were we blowing out that changed the pH? CO2, and that dropped the pH, and really it's pH. The low pH or the high CO2 that drives you to breathe. So if you went off on a tangent about low oxygen, we already went through that, unless you wanted to write COPD or something, right? Because we talked about the COPD as well. So you could have gone off on to something like that, but it's not the low oxygen that causes you to breathe generally, right? That was the misconception that's in textbooks that we really wanted you to make sure to get down. Okay. And then the heart rate, we've talked about that. So you could talk about the CO2, anxiety. You're going to breathe faster. You're going to have, you know, try to get that pH to regulate it as well. So there was different ways you could have answered this one. So let's do this. Muscle cramps are kind of an interesting aspect. So what might have caused the muscle cramps, and what makes the cramp go away in about 10 minutes of walking out? So muscle cramps, I just sent you a link about 5 minutes before class. On an article on muscle cramps, right? So what is muscle cramps? And it's kind of something really interesting. We have a whole center of muscle biology here, researchers in cardiovascular, athletic training,
rehabilitation sciences, basic sciences, physicians, surgeons that come to our muscle group. And we talk about these general things. So it's really quite interesting. And you hear all these, you know, different comments, and then you read and say, well, where's the study that supports that? Where's the study that supports that? Where's the proof for that, right? So generally, I think we have some misconceptions in general, in the public, and you hear about what's something that you've heard about?
Potassium buildup.
Potassium buildup?
Lactic acid buildup.
Any other ideas? Anybody ever hear of eating bananas or something, right? So how does that relate with anything? What's the banana thing do?
Potassium,
right? Potassium. And guess what? They studied that and found out it's not the lactic acid. It's not the potassium. And bananas aren't really the food to eat if you really wanted to raise potassium. A lot of other foods have more potassium per weight. Avocados, watermelon, even sweet potatoes, those little beans that you get in more of a Japanese or the delicatessen. Those little, what do they call them, indom beans, you can kind of pull apart, right? And a little pea thing comes out and eat them. You know, those are kind of neat. But a cup of those have more potassium, like twice as much potassium as the same weight as banana. But they found out it's really not potassium, because they measure potassium. And they find out it's not really low potassium. It might have to do more with sodium, actually, the low sodium. And salt. So some people say, you know, drinking like the Gatorade, right? Where does Gatorade come from? I know the Gators, right? Florida, which, ooh, right. But why do you have Gatorade? Yeah, and that it was found, right, University of Florida. They took the sweat off of people, athletes, and they looked at it and found out they could replenish all the salts back by making a drink. But actually, when you looked at the salt concentration, like this P lab that you did this week, or you're doing this week, that was too salty. So it wasn't any good. But then they reduced the salt level, and that's how Gatorade came about, basically, is the replenishing of salts. They do think that it might be salt imbalance, but not all the studies support that. So there's some controversy with that. So there's some other studies that actually think about that it might be a mismatch of your Golgi tendon organ and your muscle spindles. So the Golgi tendon, remember at the end of your muscle where it joins to the tendon, there's at that myotendinous junction, that's where sensory receptors are, and you sense that stretch, and especially if you overstretch it, it can be a negative feedback on the alpha motor neuron and cause decreased contractions. Like when you see somebody lifting heavy weights and all of a sudden they drop it, it's probably these Golgi tendons, organs coming back and inhibiting alpha motor neurons. So they think it might even be a mismatch between the Golgi tendons and muscle spindles. Anybody ever get a Charlie horse while you're sleeping at night? Right? Did you overexercise at night? Is that, you know, is lactic acid building up? No. So there's some, and what do you do if you get a Charlie horse and your toe like cramps up and goes to these weird contortions, right? And what do? You stand up really quick, right? And you put some weight on it. Y'all haven't, not everybody's experienced this? I hate these things. You know, you'd like jump out of bed. Yikes. And the covers wrap around your toe and you can't get out fast enough, right? You're like falling on your head to get out. You push down, and that resets your Golgi tendon organ and resets your muscle spindles, and the cramps go away. That's kind of interesting. So there's some idea behind that. But it doesn't support all the types of cramps that people have had. They do think there's a nice correlation with temperature. If you're really hot, and it's like a hot, humid day, and then you're exercising, you're more likely to have cramps. But then there were studies done where marathon runners in the cold, and they showed that they still got cramps and it was cold outside and it wasn't related to that. And so they've done blood samples on runners and all this kind of stuff. So there's a lot of mixed ideas. So when you read that article I sent you, it's basically, don't know, it's probably a combined different aspects. So it's not really well understood what causes these cramps. Now some are hypothermic, they do know that if it's too hot, for example. But then you think about when you get a cramp, like in a large muscle, it might be localized. It might be just in, you know, it's not the whole muscle, but it's a, like a point, like somebody hit you right in there. They got, you know, hit right in that one little spot with a, you know, ice pick or something, right? So it could be localized right there. But anyways, to have that muscle contract, right, that's the cramp itself. But why is it that you feel it? I mean, this is so, there's so many things in physiology that's just general, but then go down to the mechanisms and you go, whoa, we still don't know the very detailed mechanisms of that. It's bizarre. So then you have that large muscle, but it's a region that might be fasciculating, actually, going back and forth and contracting. And that can cause this cramp lookalike. But how do you sense that cramp? Cramp. Right? So going to the next question. Then some people said, you know, the muscle detects this. Is it the muscle that detects that? To sense, to perceive the cramp? It has to be sensory neurons, right? So ideas might be that lactic acid, that pH that builds up, I mean the hydrogen ion that builds up, or lactic acid that builds up. Because remember, if you have metabolism, like that muscle's working, what's the byproduct? CO2, and that drops your pH. pH, low pH actually activates sensory endings of your pain cells, of your pain neurons. Now I know that was a little while back, but you know, general ideas that some metabolite, if you wrote that, you got the points for it. If you wrote potassium, I know that was the fad, and that's a general idea, so you know, just that you're thinking about something. Or lactic acid, that's okay, but that's been demythed as well for the total cramp. But the idea is that cramps come about in lots of different reasons. And some of it might be hyperthermia, some of it might be low salts, might be mostly sodium, not the potassium. It's not totally lactic acid, because they measure people with high lactic acid and they don't get cramps. Or they can actually inject lactic acid and show that the muscle's not cramping as what they would anticipate for a level that would that they've measured in people with cramps. So it's really quite confusing. It's not so straightforward. But if you listed, you know, how does a cramp happen, I mean, how do you perceive it, then you have to write sensory neurons, right? So you could have wrote multiple types of responses here. If you wrote, you know, low pH, buildup of lactic acid. What else did we say? Increased motor nerve stimulation, maybe unregulated activity. If you happen to know about like the muscle spindle and Golgi organ, you know, say a mismatch of sensory input, that's, you know, thought about in a case like the Golgi and alpha spindle. And then what makes the cramp go away after 10 minutes? So some people forgot to answer the second half of the question. Well, walking it out, they say that helps with the cramps. And maybe it's the blood supply, so if you wrote that in, that's okay. Washing out the lactic acid, washing out the low pH, taking away the CO2, raising the pH back up, right? Or, in some cases, it's thought that actually resetting the alpha motor neuron into sensory neurons, again, in a normal kind of pattern, instead of just that real fast, you know, high active pattern. But you can get cramps without really over-exercising a lot. Anybody swim? We got swimmers, right? Swim. You ever get cramps when you're swimming, right? Your toe, and you're like, well, don't want to sink to the bottom of the pool. And but it might not be as bad, as much exercise as somebody running, right? That would be even more use on that muscle. But the lack of being able to put weight on your leg, if you get a cramp in your leg, primarily, right? And it's the lack of that weight, that pressure on your foot, and resetting that Golgi tendon and muscle spindle again. So you put one foot behind the other, and you try to pull that one up, and then the other leg cramps, and then you just hope you get to the edge of the pool before you go down. Right. Okay. So that's part of it. All right, so lots of different answers could have been taken there, so that's fine. Perceived. So when we talk about perceived, what are we looking for?
I have a question about that. Mm-hmm. What if you said, like,
that was okay.
Okay. And then walking it out would just give
Let it come back to normal again. That's a possibility. I mean, those are good logical answers, right? And so, you know, you do an experiment to find it. So something like that, you know. As long as you're thinking on something physiologically, you probably got points for it. And when I finally finish grading these and get them back to you, you can come back and say, well, you can correct me because I'm grading them like at 12 o'clock at night. All right. So anyways, all right. Perceived. So we have to have sensory, CNS, right? CNS. There's your perceived, right? That something's going on in the brain, that you can pick it up. Some people wrote sensory cortex. That's fine or whatever. You know, that you've had it, right? That you
perceive the pain. Right? Where we could electrically stimulate that part in your brain and you would feel it too. All right, so lacrimal drunk, and I tried to, you know, say what this was about, tear producing. So all we wanted to do is, you don't have to know exactly the innervation to it. You don't have to know all that aspects, but if you got real bad pain, if we stabbed your hand with an ice pick, you know, you're going, ouch, right? And then you might bring tears to your eyes. How does that happen? Think about it. Just sensory neurons, CNS, something in the CNS pain center, then sends neurons to your lacrimal gland to cause it to contract and produce a tear, right? Or something that, you know, it's just that pathway, that mechanism, okay? Something like that. It's actually, people have, and it's in some textbooks, and I think we even had a slide on that before when we were talking about the sympathetic and parasympathetic system, thought that it might be part of the trigeminal nerve, but they've actually showed it wasn't really that. It's the, along with the trigeminal nerve, is the parasympathetic innervation. It's actually parasympathetic control on the lacrimal gland. So it's kind of interesting, but they say it's a branch of that trigeminal nerve, and that the parasympathetic goes along with that and innervates the lacrimal gland. So it's actually activation of the parasympathetic. It's kind of interesting in that aspect. Okay, so that's neat. But, you know, some just general logical answer. You got points for that? Okay, so burned out, you know, really tired. So some people said cortisol levels are high. Well, if we inject cortisol levels in you, would that cause you to feel burned out, you know, right away, right? Maybe, but what's the connection with this? And what would be the connection with epinephrine? Sympathetic.
Switching back from the sympathetic to the parasympathetic system, and you had that lethargy from the beginning, plus you were just working extra hard there, so you burned even more energy during that event.
Yes, exactly. So think about, you're so tired after an exam. You took this long exam, and you're burned out, and you're like, you finished the physics test, and you're not ready to just, you know, jump all over the place unless the caffeine's kicked in or something. But the, you know, you burned out. What? Why is you focus so much, right? You've used the cells. What do you think blood glucose is like after a real traumatic event and you exercised really hard and you maybe mobilized it, but you kept exercising? So it goes up. Sympathetic activates this, right? Cortisol could activate then to cause glycogen breakdown and gluconeogenesis. But then that glucose is up, and then it's going to go into your muscles, and then what do you get? Low glucose, right? If you have low glucose in your blood, then that's not going to your brain, and you feel pretty tired, right? So this kind of ideas that you're saying about, but also if you had a high sympathetic, and then you brought it down, like, you know, somebody scared you, you kind of feel relaxed afterwards. It's basically the parasympathetic that's still going on there. So you could have had multiple answers here. I just wanted something related, like with your glucose utilization, you know, that it's down, maybe your lactic acids build up, maybe that would cause you to feel tired, maybe the high CO2, you know, something logical, and here you got the points. Okay, and if you think about this event hours later, and you think about, oh, I had all those questions and I forgot to turn the page over and answer all the back of your exam, and I just now realized that, and you're going to have an anxiety attack afterwards, right? So what's happening there? Your sympathetic system is kicked in again. So back to question one, full back again, right? So even the thought, you can hype yourself up right here. You can get yourself excited, right? And your sympathetic nervous system is going to kick in. Epinephrine is going to be released. So the same idea. You've activated your sympathetic nervous system, even with that anger, fear, frustration, and you then straight to your adrenal gland, raised your epinephrine, goes to the heart, raises the heart rate, are sympathetic directly to the heart, right? Because you have direct innervation on the heart with your sympathetic. So you get the ideas? So arrows, you know, first, right? If in some other class, if you had to write open, you know, full sentences, then you could at least do your arrows, do your schematic, do your outline, and then fill it in. But here, we're basically, we understand what you mean with these arrows, and that's really pretty quick to answer the question, right, to the main points. But it also helps you to think logically about how to answer. So open response questions, do that. Okay. Let me just check this out. So pretty good. So, yeah. And you could go off on other aspects too on it. You could think about other points. All right, so that's good. All right, are we good? Generally, get an idea of how to answer these open response questions and stuff. Okay. Let's cruise. Okay, so where are we? We are up here somewhere. You might want to look through these little pages I put up here, too. They're kind of interesting. We'll get to this and hopefully open these files up, too. I sent you this article about exercise-associated muscle cramps on Canvas just now. All right, so you can kind of check that out for your own benefit. But it's kind of neat. It's really interesting. All right. Okay, so that took a lot of time. But hopefully that gets you the idea of how to think about answering questions, right? That's the important part. It's not just cram in all the information, but logically thinking about it. So we left off with clot formation and clot breakdown. And clot formation is fast, right? You don't want to be leaking out blood or plasma out into your extracellular fluid. But you don't want those clots to stay there all the time either and then break loose and go somewhere in your brain and block a capillary bed. So they slowly break them down, and then that epithelial can repair itself. All right, so just the idea of these clot formations, really quite interesting. And then we think about circulation in, you know, the general point, coming back to the beginning of this chapter. Why do we have circulation? Right? Gas exchange, nutrient exchange, and then you start to look at animals with thicker tissue, right, muscle, then you get down to more detailed circulatory system, right? Branching and capillary beds, and then you know you got to get that blood back around. So it's a really nice structure function relationship. But some animals really don't have much of a circulatory system because they're so thin, they can get gas exchange right across their membrane, right across their surface, and they're not very thick, so they don't really need that. Like a planaria, for example, they can exchange gases across their membrane, and nutrients are relatively easily distributed in that body because it's so small. Then you get like circulatory systems like the leech, which is really quite interesting, just to kind of refresh your memory about, you know, annelids, earthworms. They can have that pulsatile. Some of them actually use red blood. Hemoglobin as a respiratory pigment. They can pump that part one direction and reverse it the other. Some animals, like this leech, is really wild in the sense that its whole ventral nerve cord. This is the nerve cord, right? The ganglion, 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 like segment. The whole ventral nerve cord and the connectives between the ganglion for that segment are inside the blood vessel. You ever heard of an animal doing that? That's just wild, right? So the whole ventral nerve cord is inside of the blood vessel that's used for circulation. It's not the blood that they suck blood in and eat. That stays in the GI tract and gets the nutrients out. So this is the animal's blood supply. So just think of your nervous system inside of your blood vessels. Kind of wild, different, right? So there are lots of interesting things that are out there that's quite interesting. And then the little roots come off, and there's like a stalking of that blood vessel that seals it off so the blood doesn't leak out here, but it can go back and forth and then has like diffusion, capillary beds basically out to the tissue. Pretty neat. So if we think of different ways that animals can pump blood, lots of variation out there. Mostly like us, if we just stand here and like you're sitting there, blood's probably pooling in your leg. And then you contract your muscles in your leg, and that contraction of the muscles helps to mobilize that blood. So people on long flights, for example, if you're going a long flight, the stewardess or flight attendants, I guess we call the people now, the flight attendants, they're actually what might have you do some exercises. They might say, okay, we're, you know, landing soon, you know, it's been 10 hours in the air, yeah, you should, you know, move your legs around, do some exercise, stand up. They try to get you to do that. Sometimes, after these long flights, when people don't do that, like they're asleep the whole time and they're kind of sitting up, that blood's really pooling down in their legs, right? They get up, they move, they're in the hallway, the aisleway, they take a few steps, and boom, they flat down. What happened? What do you think? Sitting there for a long time, not moving the blood, what happens when blood stays still? Clots. And now you got up and you moved. And that clot moved. Let's say it moved from your, you know, a vein down in your leg, and you clot, clot, clot. Right? Once one clot forms, kind of that gets that more clot forming, and then that's going to break loose, and where's it going to go? Comes in, goes into the right atrium, right ventricle. What's next?
the pulmonary artery, boom, had a pulmonary emboli. And it hit in there and blocked, and they can't get oxygen. Then what's going to happen? Boom. That's happens. So even in hospitals, somebody's in a bed for a long time. This is why the bed ruling is really important, right? They move a patient, and they might have, you know, on the bed sheet, move them up, get their head on the pillow, and all of a sudden, pulmonary emboli, die right there, right? So that can happen in a hospital. That's why they put those things around the legs to keep them to move, and that's not that uncommon. It happens, right? In nursing homes, too, and things like that. So it's really important to keep that mobilization going on. Critical. This is why people, too, with AFib or things like that, with their heart that's not beating right, they're more susceptible to blood clots as well because the blood is not moving like it should, right? So really important. And you think about that exercise, or if you're sitting still too long, studying animal phys for hours on end, you want to get up and walk around, do things, right? Okay. So when you think about even moving like in an animal, cow, horse, and then you think about blood vessels that can actually promote blood flow one direction. It's really quite interesting. William Harvey, if you're into the history of biology or physiology, he really understood quite a bit about the circulatory system, and he was a comparative. He was a physician for some king in England, and he was afraid to report what he had actually found by using comparative studies on dogs, cats, all these different animals, because it was going to go against the philosophy or what was already put by the Italian anatomists, which were the kings in the field at the time, and he didn't want to go against them. This is like science. You have to be careful, right? There's just politics in that too. And so he was very careful. He didn't want to publish his work because it was going against the grain of what people had thought. They thought gases just kind of like came in and made your muscles larger, right? And that's why you get, you know, your bicep gets bigger, the gas is pumped into there, and that's how this is all working. And so, but he said, no, this isn't right. So he held on for like 10 years after he already had written all his stuff up, and finally he published his book and really understanding the circulatory system, and then everybody realized, oh yeah, we thought about this all wrong. And he looked at it in multiple animals. So just on yourself, you could, you know, hold your hand down, right? And you can see your veins. You can put your finger on one of those veins and move it up like that, and it goes flat, right? It's pretty cool. It goes flat for right there, and then there's a little spot, and then you can push backwards. So if you get cousins over the holidays and stuff, torture them, you know, brothers, sisters, nephews, nieces, do experiments on them. And then you can find out that right there is where that little valve is on your vein, because you see it backs up, and it doesn't, you know, it's flattened on the other side. So you can actually find where your little valves are that allow the blood to go one direction, right? So it doesn't pool so much. So once you push that blood past that valve, now it's working its way up. What's really interesting is we're upright animals, so we don't have those valves in our veins in our brain. Isn't that cool? Because we're usually standing up, right? We don't stand on our head, right? But if you do, you might pass out because the blood pools. Not a good thing to do. But then if you look at other animals, like a dog with a head that's down, they actually have valves in the blood vessels, the veins, in their head. Pretty cool. Lots of interesting aspects like that. All right, so, and then we think about multiple hearts. I don't want you to memorize different animals with different hearts, but that some animals have multiple hearts that actually keep the blood flowing. If you think of a fish that's, you know, swimming really fast, maybe the main heart isn't enough to keep the blood moving around. They actually have a caudal heart in their circulatory system that pumps blood towards the main heart to keep it going, because otherwise it would pool, right? So it's pretty neat to think about all the different aspects. So I just want you to appreciate and kind of understand that some animals have multiple hearts, like a caudal heart, to keep the blood flowing so it doesn't pool in the tail end. We've talked about insect hearts already. And also for temperature regulations, they can actually see, like a bumblebee, if it's a cold day, their heart beats, but they actually shunt more blood to their abdomen to warm up, you know, if it's a sunny day. So it's really quite interesting that that can happen, and it's also for heat regulation. If they were hot and they keep using their wings and their metabolism's high and the body temperature's going to rise because of metabolism, they, even though they're still, they can try to shunt blood more towards the abdomen if there was like air blowing across it. So it's not just a simple system. It can actually be regulated in insects and crustaceans. Okay.
So the main ideas, we've talked about these open circulatory system with OSTI, these holes that allow blood to come in. We've talked a little bit about extra types of hearts, pumps. But the idea is like a fish heart. So some of these things we have to know. So a fish heart, in general, has two chambers, an atrium and a ventricle. There's some subtle other anatomical differences. I don't want to go into all the details. The main point is an atrium and a ventricle. What does the atrium do for us, mostly? Is it really to force blood out through your whole body? The atrium is just to prime your ventricle, and your ventricle is the main pump, right? So the ventricles are the main pump. So these atria help pool the blood, get into the ventricle right before it contracts, so you're priming that pump by pushing that blood into the ventricle, so it's not a high-pressure system, and then get into the ventricle, and then with that ventricle contracts, close the valves, even in us, same as in a fish, close the valves so the blood doesn't go back in the atrium, but then it's forced out towards the body or to the gill chamber. Okay. Us, birds, we have a two-pump system. We have a pulmonary system, right? And then we have the systemic system. So let's look through this, and we need to know the anatomy of like a mammalian heart, okay? And you just, again, blank piece of paper is the easy way to remember this. So blood comes in from the veins, right? All veins go to the heart, right? So veins to the heart on the right side, generally, right? Right atrium goes through a little chamber there, that atrium. What's it going to do? Prime, contract, push blood into the right ventricle. There's a valve there. Anybody remember the name of that valve? If you're allied health, you got to know that because it might be on a standardized exam. Tricuspid. Why tricuspid? Because it has the three kind of cusps to the valve. Another way, if you're in Boy Scouts, you can maybe remember the Boy Scouts salute, three fingers, tricuspid, something corny. Okay, girls, sorry. But so the tricuspid on the right side, that's the tricuspid valve. And then it goes into the right ventricle, pumps. Where is it going into? What's the name of that next blood vessel? All arteries leave the heart. So that's the pulmonary artery, right? So it's leaving. Now, is that highly oxygenated? But this is the misconception all the time. All arteries are highly oxygenated, right? So here's an artery probably with the lowest oxygenation in your body because it's now pulling into everything, right? And even the lymphatic system, which we'll get to, has dumped into the venous return. It's not highly oxygenated. So now we get the mixing of the lymphatic system with the venous blood coming back. It's not deoxygenated. Don't get the idea that there's no oxygen there. There's still a good amount of oxygen, but it's the lowest oxygen that's in there at the time in your circulatory system. So now, where's it going through? Your lungs, right? And it has to branch all throughout the lungs. So that's a lot of capillary bed, a tremendous amount of surface area. But if you're not exercising, generally, you don't perfuse all of your lung. If you're standing up, you're probably just perfusing the bottom part of your lung. If you start exercising, moving around, blood pressure goes up, and you start perfusing the rest of your lung, right? So you have a lot of reserve to perfuse and get more oxygenation or more CO2 out. But generally, we're probably just perfusing the lower part of our lung, standing up or sitting up, unless you're laying down. Okay, so then it goes out of the lungs, goes into, what's the main structure called? Pulmonary vein, right, going back. So now we have a vein, and is it highly oxygenated or low oxygenated? Highly oxygenated. So now we have a vein that's probably the highest oxygenated part of your body, right, in the circulatory system. But it's a vein, right, not arteries, what we generally think about. So the pulmonary vein then goes into the left atrium, right, left atrium, left ventricle, left ventricle. There's another valve there between the left atrium and the left ventricle, what is? Bicuspid. And then that goes into the left ventricle. Now that left ventricle has to contract and push the blood out to the whole body, right? So what do we expect there? That has to have high pressure, right? So that's where the high pressure really is. And that's the part of the thickness of the wall on the left ventricle is thicker than on the right ventricle because it doesn't have to be as thick. Now we have to pump blood out through the whole systemic circulation. Your kidneys, your liver, your muscles,
adipose tissue, right? And so the larger you are, that's more capillaries that have to, I mean, marked by extra adipose tissue that is having to pump through that all that capillary bed, so you're actually putting more stress on the heart. So what happens with the heart over time has to get thicker, bigger. So this is why you're more likely to have hypertension if you have overweight, for example, because now you have a lot more tissue that you've got to try to perfuse through. So that can help with hypertension to reduce that extra tissue. So the left side, very important. What do we call that valve that goes out to the, and then that out to that blood vessel that goes to the systemic circulation? Aorta, right? Aortic valve, right? So in the aortic valve. So now that we have that ventricle that pumped that blood into the aorta, and then the ventricle relaxes, what keeps the blood from coming back? It's going to close that valve, right? Boom. Right. So that's the closing of that valve to keep it going. But if it was a steel pipe, let's just think about the steel pipe. If we had a steel pipe of your aorta, a steel pipe, and you pumped fluid into a steel pipe, what's going to happen to the pressure? And that steel pipe runs a long ways, right? It's going to go up really high, and then as that pump relaxes, it's going to drop really low, right? So you'd have a high systolic and a low diastolic, right, if it was like a steel pipe. But your aorta is what's called compliant. It has elasticity. It's compliant. It will stretch. So it stretches. You push blood into it, it stretches. And then the ventricle relaxes, boom, that valve closes. But what's going to happen now? It's going to come back down and help with that pressure, maintaining that pressure. So that elasticity keeps the pulse pressure better in check. You're not going to go as high with systole, and you're not going to go as low in systole in the low pressure, right? So it helps you maintain a mean arterial pressure without having a high systole and a low diastole. So they check that when you do a blood pressure check. And if you had a high systole and a low diastole, you might have what? What makes a steel pipe in your blood vessels? Atherosclerosis, right? Like building up a plaque in there where it can't have that elasticity. So again, then more hypertension because then your system can't handle that. So you get the idea. Draw out the anatomy. Blank piece of paper is the best thing. And go through that kind of like tracing a red blood cell. All right? And then think about logically the tissue thicknesses and things like that. What's really interesting, too, is I don't think we have a picture of it in here. It's not here, but right out of the aorta, so this is kind of really interesting. And if you get a chance to shadow cardiologist or something and see this, they might, you probably will see this in an imaging picture. Right after the aorta, when it's coming out of the ventricle, and those flaps open up, right behind the flap is the coronary artery supply. So it's really interesting that after the blood comes in, kind of comes back, and when the ventricle relaxes, that's when you get the most blood going in the coronary artery supply, when the ventricle's actually relaxed. But it's right behind these valves that there's the coronary artery supply. And then that perfuses over the heart to keep the heart tissue, because it's so thick, it's not by diffusion that tissue is getting oxygenation and nutrients, it's by the capillary beds in the heart. Right? And we saw that in the outreach center. Aortas are so thick, the aorta itself is so thick, it actually has capillary beds to feed the aorta. That's pretty cool too, right? And then think, if you have atherosclerosis, not only are coronary artery beds probably blocking up, but the little capillary beds to that thick aortic tissue are probably blocking up too. And if it can't get good oxygen supply and good nutrients, you know, or maybe it blocks up, what happens to that aorta muscle? It then dies, right? And if that dies, what happens to the high pressure? You're pumping it in there. If that tissue's weak, boom, aortic aneurysm, right? And you probably won't make it right to the ER in time because that aortic aneurysm is going to bust you out. We had a grad student that was actually here a number of years ago that was upstairs on the third floor, and he wasn't in the best health, and he was feeling really lethargic. He walked over to the ER, and he just knew something was wrong. He was dizzy. It was on a weekend. And when by the time he got to the ER, his aorta had busted. He had a busted aortic aneurysm. But then he went into a coma and he died from that. But it was just, you know, a really bad situation. But you hear of athletes that have aortic aneurysms, right? And they're really pushing hard, and they might not know it until they're finally in sports, like in high school. They're playing basketball or football, and they're really pushing themselves. And they might have had a weak
aorta are sometimes they're not in the best physical shape with adipose tissue and things, and they're really working hard, but they already had a weak blood vessels, and so then it really exacerbates that problem. So coaches are really good first catches if they work people correctly and not overwork them too fast, right? Kind of interesting. So these ideas of the right and left ventricles, now, are they working one works, like right atrium works, right ventricle works, and then the left atrium and left ventricle work? No. They're working together, right? So the both atria contracting together, pushing blood into the ventricles. Both ventricles contracting together, pushing blood out. It's not in a series, right? But sometimes these figures confuse people. So it's working together. Both atria are contracting pretty much simultaneously. Both ventricles pretty much pumping simultaneously. Trick question, does the right ventricle pump more blood or the left ventricle pump more blood out per minute? Trick question. Think of the logic on this. It's a closed system. Right? So they have to pump the same amount, right? They have to pump the same amount. So they pump the same amount of blood out, right? And if this is a closed system, where is the lowest blood pressure? Trick question. You know, is it the arteries? Is it the arterioles? Is it the capillary bed? Is it the venules? Or is it the vein? Or is it right before the heart, like in the inferior superior vena cava, right before it comes back into the heart? Pressure. Can blood go against the pressure? Or does it always have to go follow the pressure circle? Answers. Ideas. What do you think? If it was the lowest pressure in your capillary bed, and it was, and your veins were higher, would blood go into the veins? No, right? So where is the lowest pressure in this closed system? Right before the pump. So right before the pump, right before the atrium, right? So it's going to be right there, like in your vena cava, right before the atrium, okay? So just kind of think logically of it all. Now, I know that physics is like, I forgot, but it's generalized. Blood flow, really important that it is streamlined blood flow. If you have little clots in there, like little atherosclerosis clots, what's going to happen with your blood flow? It's actually going to go around that clot, and it's going to have little whorls in here, right? And those little whorls, if it's not flowing really well, what happens as that blood kind of stays stagnant right here and it's not flowing after the clot? What's going to happen right there? You're going to get clots, right? And then those clots break loose and problems, right? So laminar flow is really important, too, not to have these clots in there, and that's really important. And then, you know, closing these valves as if it's in the, like, for the aortic valve or the semilunar valves. Okay. So know the valves, generally, which we talked about, aortic or pulmonary semilunar valves also. Chordae tendons, we saw these when we went to the outreach center, right? If you had a heart attack and this tissue died right here, what would happen to that little structure right there? That might break loose, right? And if that breaks loose, what happens to that valve? When that part of the ventricle contracts, that valve isn't going to be able to stop anymore, and it's going to invert back into the atrium, and that's going to cause a problem, right? So really quite interesting to think about keeping that healthy heart. So know the general ideas of this flow and what's going on with this, and we can kind of go to the next picture on this. We've already talked about muscle before, but for that electrical flow through the heart, what do we have to have? Gap junctions, right? Gap junctions. And so to allow that electrical flow. Now, if we're going to have heart to contract, where's the calcium come for a heart contraction versus your skeletal muscle in amount? Calcium in your skeletal muscle comes from where? For finding component C? From the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And how about the heart? Sarcoplasmic reticulum and extracellular, right? Because you have voltage-gated calcium channels on the heart tissue itself. So calcium's two places on the cardiac, sarcoplasmic reticulum, as well as across the plasma membrane. And cardiac muscle is striated, right? We talked about that. It's striated versus smooth muscle where you don't see the striations. It's just not as long of these striations in myofibrils that you see for real long distances, because it's kind of these branching patterns that we see in cardiac muscle. And that's because of the way it wraps around and makes the heart. So it's really quite interesting. All right, so we've talked about this, gap junctions, desmosomes that hold it all together, keep these tissues together. You can think about the heart contracting, you know, pulling apart the heart, really something. All right, and we talked about neurogenic hearts, like with crustaceans. You cut the nerves, the heart will stop. Myogenic hearts, pacemaker potentials that can be generated in it, just like a little maggot Drosophila in a larval stage, they're myogenic. There's some ideas about how the pacemaker works, and you can imagine this is really important to control heart rate, right? And to control blood pressure, people try to regulate these ion channels with pharmacological agents. That's a billion-dollar industry out there in pharmaceutical companies. So there's some different ideas about, and do you know that this is still not completely hammered out? People still question about the ion movements and how this works, and you think, wow, what year is this, right? And this is still debated a bit about exactly the mechanisms that are going on. And people are still trying to understand some subtleties to it. But the general idea is this, and we'll go through another point here a little bit, is that when you're, and you don't really have a resting membrane potential totally because it's always pacing, right? These are like your pacemaker cells. So what's happening? When the cell is in a hyperpolarized state, or lower state, let's say more negative state, this is an interesting channel. This kind of goes against what you generally have thought. This is what is called a sodium funny channel. Now, why do they call it funny? Because it behaves funny. And it's not what they normally think of a sodium channel. So they call it a funny channel. It actually opens up when the membrane hyperpolarizes, when it's more negative. So when it's more negative, the channel opens. But where's the E-sodium? Way up here somewhere, right? So if you open the channel when you're negative, what did you do? That's a large driving gradient, right? Sodium's really going to want to go in. And if sodium really goes in, then you depolarize. As you depolarize, what if you had other channels that are sensitive to voltage change, like a voltage-gated calcium channel? Now you've opened up a voltage-gated calcium channel that might be sensitive to that small change, and that's what happens here. We get this opening of the transient, this T-type calcium channel, and it's transient, but it's sensitive to that small change in that voltage. So now it opens up, calcium dumps in, it's going to close, it actually is just a transient, so it inactivates, and that more depolarization opens up another calcium channel called this L-type calcium channel. It's a more long-lasting calcium channel, so the L. And that opens up, and then now what's going to happen? E-calcium's way up there, like at plus 120. So you've got a large driving gradient to push calcium into the cell. So now calcium's going to go in, and then, oh, what happens? Like in the action potential. Now we have potassium channels that are going to open, voltage-gated potassium channels. And that's going to help try to bring it back down. But we still have calcium that was activated, but now it's going to be counteracted by the potassium. So we start the whole cycle over again. These start to close because that's what opened them, the voltage change. But if potassium's still flowing out, that brings it back down, and then you start the whole cycle all over again. So that's kind of interesting to think about. All right? Neat? All right, so SA node, we should know the electrical excitation of the heart. And you have that lab on that. So SA node, what's your normal pacemaker activity in you, a human? What's your heart rate, general? Heart rate, rate. Pump.
60 to
100. 100? 60 to 80. Yes, 60 to 80, like 70, right? Around 70 beats per minute, right? So that's your SA node that's, you know, 70 beats a minute, right? And so that's beating, and then that sends electrical signals to what? Your atrium, right? And then it's going down to what the next node is called? Between your atrium and your ventricle is AV node, right? And so that goes down to the AV node. Now something very unusual happens in the AV node. It actually slows down. So you actually get a slowing down of electrical conduction. And then the AV node goes to what? Between the septum of the two ventricles? The bundle of His.
And then that bundle of His branches off to fibers in your ventricle, which are called Purkinje fibers. And then they innervate the ventricles, right? To keep the, or not really innervate, but distribute out to the ventricles to keep them going. What's really cool is if you stop the SA node, the AV node takes over. So let's say we had 70 beats a minute, and now that tissue, let's say it's died, the AV node will take over. It has its own pacemaker activity, and it might be somewhere between 50 and 60 beats a minute, you know, in a relaxed state, right? And if that tissue died, the bundle of His takes over, and it has its own pacemaker activity. And let's say that's maybe 40 to 50 beats a minute. If the bundle of His tissue is dead, guess what? The Purkinje fibers have their own pacemaker activity, and that might be around 20 to 30 beats a minute. Wow, what a reduction, you know, what a process to help keep the heart going, right? Knock out one part, and the other part takes over. But what happens if you had a block between the SA node and the AV node, and that tissue couldn't communicate? Well, the AV node is going to take over its pacemaker activity at maybe 50 to 60 beats a minute, and the AV node is beating at 70 beats a minute. So what's happening? Your atria are beating faster than your ventricles are beating, right? So then you have a problem. So these are what's called these different blocks, and you can see it on an EKG trace. Really quite interesting, because as the heart depolarizes, ions move, and you can pick up that electrical movement with electrodes, right? Like an EMG, electromyogram, electrocardiogram, or an EEG in your brain. So really quite neat. So do know the electrical pathway of the mammalian heart. You had frogs, and it's a bit different in the frogs. But, you know, at least know the mammalian system. And that might appear if you're taking standardized exams, and also those pacemaker activities in the different regions. Okay. So we went through kind of the pacemaker potential. What's interesting, and this has appeared on standardized exams quite a bit, if you looked at the ventricular muscle and you stabbed it, and you looked at the action potential to cause muscle contraction, right? Not the electrical flow so much, but the muscle contraction of the ventricle. Those potentials look like this. And these are really quite interesting, because here's the key point. Look how long this is. 250 milliseconds. Wow, that's really long, because your action potential in the nerves are about a millisecond, right? So this is really long. The main point here is that sodium comes in, kind of like what you've normally thought about, like with the action potential, and then potassium will come out, but the calcium is staying open, and that's the reason for the plateau. The voltage-gated calcium channels stay open, and calcium is still flowing into the cell, still maintains the depolarization. So standardized test questions are, what maintains the plateau in the ventricular action potential in those ventricular muscles? It's calcium, right? And then it will start to close up, potassium's taking over, and it will come back down to the resting state. Okay. So why would we have a long calcium entry and a long action potential in the ventricular muscle? That's the rationale. Why would we have it mechanistically? What does the ventricular muscle need to do? Not like an action potential, you know, real fast. It needs to contract, right, for a long period of time and get that blood out, right? So it sustains that contraction to then help get that blood out of that chamber, right? So that's the rationale behind that. All right. And we talked about calcium coming from sarcoplasmic reticulum as well as the across the plasma membrane. Okay. So the same idea that we just talked about with contraction, long period of contraction. EKGs are really amazing. You've done these in labs, so lab content on the test is part of this too. But we should know P wave, QRS, T complex, right? What's the P wave? Chop, 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 chop. Atrial depolarization, right? QRS, ventricular depolarization. T wave, ventricular repolarization. These should just be, you know, right in your head, really going. Why do we not see the atrial repolarization? Because of the, it's buried in the QRS is a general answer, but actually it's kind of a misnomer too, because if you had a separation of like the atrium and the ventriculars beating, and that separating, you see P wave, QRS wave, P wave, QRS wave, you know there's a problem, right? But when that happens, you don't really see the atrial repolarization. So it's kind of a misnomer that we kind of think about atrial repolarization going on in the QRS. It just, it's in the literature, it's there, it's on standardized exams still. But when you see these kind of disease cases where you could have P wave, and QRS, you don't really see an atrial repolarization so much. So it's kind of interesting. I don't want you to memorize exact numbers, but we should think about this. When the atrial depolarize, right, the electrical event, then we have the atrial contract. And this is the ventricular contraction, the QRS. So what happens in this PR segment, it's going through the what? The AV node. It actually slows down in that AV node. So the PR interval is important to understand AV function, right? AV node function, that it's actually working right, and that's why people use these segments. There's so much information that's gained from the EKG traces. It's amazing because you can learn so much about the heart, and it's non-invasive, right? The shapes of these events depends on which lead you're recording from. If it's like lead 1 or lead 2 or lead 3 on the body, or a 12 EKG lead. So they do vary. People ask questions in the past years, why are they so different? It depends on the lead one's recording from. Now here's something that people don't normally see in a lot of it. It's this U wave. And those appear sometimes. So a U wave isn't that uncommon, but it can happen too. I don't know if you picked it up on lab once. Our lab equipment's not, you know, clinically certified, but and then sometimes there's noise. And so you might have seen that. It's kind of interesting. But do know kind of what's going on in these different regions. Just logically think it through. You know, the QRS, ventricular depolarization. So what's happening at this point in time? Ventricles are contracting. Blood's going out of the ventricles into either the pulmonary artery or the aorta, right? The ventricle's relaxing here. Blood's coming from the atrium back into the ventricles if it's relaxing. Okay. So these are up there. You don't have to memorize the times, but you might want to look through kind of what's going on at the different times. All right. And what's kind of interesting is this QRS wave and the sounds. So let's listen. Lub-dub, right? Like Jaws. Anybody ever see Jaws? Best movie ever. Scares you to death. Right? So lub-dub. What are the sounds doing? Lub-dub. What are those sounds referring to? Okay. So the valves. So let's think about this. The ventricles contract. What's happening? They're pushing the blood. Pressure's building up. Where's that pressure going to go? It's going to try to push the blood. The pulmonary artery and the aorta are higher pressure, right? So you have to exceed the pressure to open up those valves to get blood to go into those, right? But what just happened? Blood came into the ventricles because the atrium contracted. So there's not much pressure left in the atrium. So what's first going to happen? Contract the ventricles. You're going to push blood back against the tricuspid and bicuspid and close them, right? So you're closing the valves to the atrium from the ventricles to the atrium so you don't get backflow into the atrium. So that's lub. And then what happens? Pressure's still building up. Finally, the aorta and pulmonary blood's going into the arteries, right? And then the ventricles relax, and what happens to that blood? Comes back a little bit and closes the aortic valve and pulmonary valve, right? So lub-dub. It's actually closing of the atrial valve, lub, and then closing of the aorta and pulmonary artery valve, semilunar valves, that makes the dub. So lub-dub. What would happen if you heard lub-dub-swish? What do you think would happen? Right? Regurgitation, right? Or something. Or you hit lub-swish-dub. Well, probably the valves to the atrium, from the ventricle to the atrium, aren't working right because the blood's swishing back in. So the sounds are so important to understand. And you can go online and you can click heart sounds. Oh my gosh, there's so many out there, all these different disorders, and put yourself to sleep or something. Listening to all these different heart sounds. But they tell you all these different types of things. It's so cool. If you're really interested in medicine, health, these are things that you might be interested in listening to. So these heart sounds are really quite cool because they relate with how the heart's functioning. So we talked about lub-dub. There's actually a heart sound, and you shouldn't hear this in like neonates, these sounds 3 and 4. But we have something for Kentucky, and that is the sound 3. And they break it up, and it's actually in textbooks, Kentucky, because you can hear that, Kentucky, when you're listening. And it's a part about the blood coming back. It's not really
valvular in origin, it's thought to be that oscillation of the blood coming back into the atrium to refill the atrium. And there's actually, oops, I had it on the PowerPoint. There's actually one called, and it's kind of off the chart here, and we have to feed, whoops, crap, okay. Feed Tennessee is actually down there too. There's a Tennessee sound, and it's a Tennessee gallop, and they basically, you can hear it because it's Tennessee, and it's like these four sounds together. So that's kind of interesting too. And they're not that common. They might happen in some athletes, for example, but it's a fourth heart sound. So anyways, I think we're ready for test, and I will double check that I didn't make you crazy and give you more test questions than what we've covered from now. We should know up to now, right? And then think about your labs that you've had before in class and those labs. And I think you'll have everything down. If you're having to think about things, this ventricular pressure waves are really good to look at. It's basically what we've talked about. But I might have to go back and look at the exam and think about this question. But we'll look at that later when we get to that point, okay? Alrighty, have fun. If you didn't pick up your old quizzes and stuff, let me come on up here.
Have a good weekend.
Yeah, you too. You have some old goodies?
You might have an old quiz. I couldn't find it, so...